our rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, so much happening. I'm broadcasting live from Washington, D.C., from the Families USA Conference here at the Mayflower Hotel. Today and tomorrow I'll be broadcasting live from the Radio Row put on by Talk Radio News Service. And Saturday I'll be out on the streets, as will many other people. And then Saturday night, the red eye home. But it's going to be an interesting weekend. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service sitting right across from me. It is so nice to see your smiling face.
This never happens.
Yes.
It's just amazing.
It's great.
I know.
It is absolutely great. A lot in the news here.
I know. You've read more than I have, I'm sure. By the way, what is the gig on Saturday? You're going to be in the streets? What are you protesting?
The Iraq war. I mean, there's going to be like a million people here in town, aren't there? Isn't that going to be a huge demonstration?
Oh, I'm staying out of town.
Yeah.
Time to boogie. Way out.
And then there's going to be a big one in San Francisco as well, and in Portland, and I think probably every major city around the country is going to have a big one. This just hit the service, the wire service here. In a new statement, House Intelligence Committee Chairman Sylvester Reyes, Democrat from Texas, he told the Center for American Progress, "I don't support the president's plan to send an additional number of troops to Iraq." He said it's not tied to a specific strategy and will only needlessly endanger more soldiers. This guy, although he was an early opponent of the war and voted against authorizing it, has, you know, he's basically a conservative Democrat. Do you know him?
Right. I don't know very much about him. I know that he was a Border Patrol agent before he became a member of Congress, and that's pretty much his background. That's all that he's known for.
And here he is, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee.
And has absolutely no experience.
Really? Well,
that's my understanding.
Well, but nonetheless, he's the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee.
Yes, he is.
And he's coming out and saying, "I'm sorry, the president says he wants more troops, but he hasn't told us that there's any good reason for it."
But I'm not sure that he would have been involved in any of the briefings that would necessarily have said that there was a need for it, because he wouldn't have been that senior if there had been briefings of the intelligence committees.
Yeah.
Assuming there were briefings. I mean, that there are complaints, aren't there, from the senators and representatives that the kind of briefings they got were pretty cursory.
All over the place, yeah. And now, also we're hearing, Don Rumsfeld is still running the Pentagon.
Get out of here.
Let me share this story. This is from today's Washington Times. On January 4th, Mr. Rumsfeld opened a government-provided transition office in Arlington and has seven Pentagon-paid staffers working for him, a Pentagon official said. The Pentagon lists Mr. Rumsfeld as a non-paid consultant, a status he needs in order to review secret and top-secret documents. The Times, then Center for American Progress, the Times reports that Rumsfeld has brought with him close advisor Stephen Cambone, a fierce advocate of the Iraq War and chief planner of questionable interrogation techniques at military and CIA detention sites around the world. And then back to the Washington Times, the Pentagon official said former secretaries, like, you know, Secretary of Defense in this case, are entitled to a transition office to sort papers, some of which can be taken with them for a library, for archives, or to write a book. That all sounds very benign, right?
It sounds benign.
The transition office, however, has raised some eyebrows inside the Pentagon. Some question the size of the staff, which includes two military officers and two enlisted men. They also ask why the sorting could not have been done from the time Mr. Rumsfeld resigned November 8th until he left the building on December 18th.
That's a reasonable question. I mean, there is time to start sorting papers, you would think.
Yeah. So the question,
and the answer to that is?
Nobody knows. But the question is Rumsfeld still running the Pentagon?
Well, I shouldn't think Director Gates would be too happy about that.
You don't know. I mean, do you have a sense yet of Gates? You know, the early messages we got were that, you know, he was his own man and he was a pretty moderate guy. But now he seems to have become another Bush toady.
I have a sense that he's a combination of the two, which is almost impossible to be. I think he would like to be his own man.
Yeah.
I think he's highly intelligent. I was quite positive about the Iraq study group. I know a lot of people were not, but I think they actually did a pretty good job and made some fairly sensible recommendations. I think he's probably has some fairly sensible thoughts about the situation over there.
Yeah.
But once you're in, you know, you drink the Kool-Aid, whether they have to open your gullet or whether you want to or not.
It's the Yeah, it's like the old IRA prisoners that they would force feed.
Yeah, they force feed you.
Force feed you.
Yeah. So he's in a situation now.
Amazing.
But I would not think that he would be crazy about having Rumsfeld running things.
Yeah. Now Barack Obama gave the opening address here.
Yes,
at this
he did. Sigh, swoon.
Yes. He really is as handsome as
he really is as handsome in person as he is on TV.
Yeah,
yes,
this is,
ladies, just to let you know,
this is one charismatic man.
Yes,
and I only heard part of it because I had to get over here and prepare for to go on the air for KPOJ. But the part that I heard, and we will be talking later with the fellow who introduced him, who's the executive director Ron Pollack of the Families USA. In his introduction, he said that Barack Obama believes that health care is a right and not a privilege. This is a massive, massive shift. I mean, we have, like, back in the 90s, one of the cornerstones of Brown versus Board of Education in 1954 was the conclusion of the Supreme Court that education is a right and not a privilege in the United States. And, I mean, once something is defined as a right, everything around it changes. Do you know, Victoria Jones, of any other politicians who have come out and just explicitly said that health care should be considered a right and not a privilege in the United States?
Ted Kennedy.
Ted Kennedy has said that.
I believe
yeah.
so.
Yeah, okay. That doesn't surprise me.
He may be the only one, and I think possibly Feingold.
Yeah, yeah.
But they may be the only ones.
Yeah. This is something, well, Bernie Sanders actually has said
Bernie
that
Sanders,
as well,
yeah.
So, yeah. So hopefully we can. I mean,
that
seems to me like the leverage point. Everybody's got a million different ideas and a million different plans, but if just a simple line of legislation saying that we consider health care to be a right and not a privilege in the United States, it would go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court would have to decide whether the preamble to the Constitution that says that one of the reasons this United States is constituted is to provide for the general welfare. And whether the general welfare includes health care, as they already concluded, it includes education. Be an interesting one.
Be very interesting. One other thing that he said, I don't know if you heard it, he said that by the end of the first term of the next president, he thought that that universal health care would be in existence.
A reality in the United States.
If he was the next president.
Well, that was implicit. But he didn't put it that way.
He said
by the end of the next presidency, health care will be,
be
universal in the United States. That's 6 years from now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not long. And that's actually pretty fast moving if you think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Also, the Congressional Budget Office reported yesterday that Bush can have his tax cuts or he can have a balanced budget. But he can't have both.
Oh, dear.
Yes. Now,
have your cake or eat it, too.
There you go. Now, inform our listeners about the Congressional Budget Office.
I can't.
Okay, then I will.
It's way too wonkish for me.
The Congressional Budget Office is a nonpartisan. It's not even bipartisan. It's nonpartisan, basically an agency that is an employee of Congress that, correct me if my understanding is wrong,
mm-hmm.
but I'm pretty sure that I'm right about this.
Yeah, so far you're right.
That at the request of individual members of Congress, will do research and write reports.
Right.
And without any particular bias. And very often it infuriates the people who ask for the reports.
It often infuriates the people who ask for the numbers. It just comes out with numbers that are numbers.
That's right.
And
this is how it is.
And it frequently infuriates the White House in particular.
Yes, yes. And has for however many years it's been in existence. Who knows? Hang on just a second here. Let me see. If that's consistent with that, then yes. Pardon me. We're
organizing guests for the show as we speak.
We're doing live radio. Now, this
yes,
is all
this
Pacific
is very
time.
Live.
So, yeah, we're doing live radio here from the Radio Row, put on by the Talk Radio News Service here at the Families USA Conference. Victoria Jones with us, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. So that's a fascinating one. And then the Libby trial,
now I have to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Do you think that the prosecution is in trouble when your first three witnesses can't remember? Because they had memory problems. His first three witnesses had memory problems.
The prosecutor's first three witnesses
had memory problems.
I've been wondering from the very beginning if Patrick Fitzgerald had any interest in doing anything that might harm this administration. I mean, you've got, essentially, Scooter Libby has already come out and said, or his attorney has already come out and said, that Rove and Cheney were going to take down Joe Wilson, that this was a political operation.
Right.
And that in the process they were going to take down a CIA operation. Lives were put at risk. In fact, that phrase, this is pretty amazing. This is in this trial.
Where's this from? Where's your reference for this one?
This is another CIA. This is from the New York Sun reports. Another CIA employee said he delivered a stark warning back in 2002 or 2003 that the Bush administration's leak could lead to the deaths of people. It's never been investigated how many people died as a result of Valerie
Plante. No idea.
But it could lead to the deaths of people. It's amazing. 16 minutes past the hour. Our number 1-866-440-THOM. We'll be taking your calls throughout the day. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back. Victoria, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Ron Pollack is here with me. He's the executive director of Families USA, the national organization for healthcare consumers that is putting on this conference, Families USA, and a marvelous conference it is. You're the guy who introduced Barack Obama just about an hour or so ago, just about 20 feet from where we're sitting. Ron Pollack, welcome to the
Tom, it's great to be with you.
Great to have you with us. Tell us what Barack Obama had to say, first of all.
Well, the most important thing, I think, that if you had a single takeaway, it was that he strongly supports universal health coverage. And he said he wants to achieve it within the time period of the next presidency. Now, he didn't say he would be president, of course, but he said health care should be a right, and he intends to make this a key issue, a top priority issue. And so I thought it was a serious commitment on his part.
This was part keynote, part campaign speech in a way.
I presume, although we actually invited the senator in June, well before he was thought to be a presidential candidate.
Yeah, although in his own mind, you never know. Ron, tell us about Families USA.
Well, Families USA is the national organization for healthcare consumers. We've been around for 24 years. Our mission is to achieve high-quality, affordable health coverage for everybody. And as part of that, we've had these conferences, like this year's conference. This is the 12th time we're doing it. It involves the most active activists in the country who focus on healthcare. And the whole purpose of this is to help them strategize and to energize them so that they can carry on this fight at the state, local, and national levels.
And who are some of the organizations and groups and people who are involved with this?
We have a broad diversity of organizations. You got organizations representing kids and seniors, people with disabilities, healthcare providers, people from communities of color, people who are represent low-income communities. It's essentially people who care about making America's healthcare system work. And these are truly the most active activists in the country.
Yeah, and a fine thing it is. What do you see, Ron Pollack, executive director of Families USA, the group that is putting this thing together? FamiliesUSA.org, by the way, the website for our listeners who may want to learn more about it, putting on this conference where we're doing this live radio row. How do you think this is going to shake out? You have Barack Obama saying health care should be a right, not a privilege. But in fact, in the United States, it's a privilege, not a right. You have him saying within 6 years we're going to have national health care. I think he's right. I don't know how it's going to happen. My personal bias is for a single-payer system. I know that Families USA doesn't advocate for any particular system. You're just advocating for health care. But what's your best sense of how this is, what the process is going to look like?
Well, Tom, for decades, we've experienced gridlock on this problem. And one group after the other became a blocker in this process.
Right.
And so we've got to build a broad coalition, and not necessarily of all the same folks who we've been working with. Families USA last week announced, along with 15 other groups, who I would characterize as strange bedfellow organizations, that really span the ideological spectrum, that we want to expand coverage, starting this year with covering America's children, and then immediately thereafter with the parents and other adults. And so I think what's going to happen this year is Congress is likely to reauthorize the so-called State Children's Health Insurance Program. There are 9 million children in the country are uninsured. We hope as part of that they cover all of America's children. With that success, hopefully that's a platform for expanding coverage for everyone else. And I'm happy to say that we now have groups that used to be blockers of coverage for now actually supporting. Well, you've got groups like the insurance industry, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the drug companies, American Medical Association.
Is this because they intend to get in and co-opt it and blow it up, or is it because they've seen the handwriting on the wall and they're just not going to be able to play this game any longer?
I don't think any of us can be proud of the fact that there are almost 47 million people in the country who are uninsured. Whether they're doctors, whether they're hospital executives, whether they're insurance people, whether they're pharmaceutical companies, you can't feel proud of our healthcare system when 47 million people are uninsured, and yet we've got the highest costs for healthcare of any country in the world.
Right. We're paying almost $6,000 per person. Japan pays about $2,500 per person. Canada, I think, is the top at $3,006 per person, and it's still half of what we're paying. And they insure everybody.
Well,
and they have better, longer lifespan and lower infant mortality.
The average cost of family health coverage today, just the premiums, is about $12,000. That doesn't include the deductibles and the co-payments
right.
and the other out-of-pocket costs you have for services that are not covered.
Right.
For too many working families, that's simply impossible to bear.
Yeah. This is just plain old flat-out nuts. I mean, there's just no other way to describe it. So Ron Pollack, he is the executive director, the founding executive director of Families USA, a national organization for healthcare consumers, familiesusa.org, the website. If you want to check it out, the conference that we're broadcasting live from here at Radio Row in Washington, D.C. Ron, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom, for inviting me.
Great speaking with you. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be back after this.
Winding up somewhere, one step ahead or behind. It ain't been so easy, but I guess I shouldn't complain. I've always been crazy. It's kept me from going insane.
And welcome back. Fair and slightly unbalanced, I guess.
Tom Hartman Radio Program here with your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, by the way, broadcasting live from the Families USA Conference. And from 6 to 8 p.m. tonight here at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C., I'll be signing my new book, Screwed: The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. It's open to the public, so if you happen to be listening in the Washington area, drop by. And, of course, tomorrow I'll be also doing the program here from this conference, and Saturday out there on the streets with zillions of other people. Speaking of out there on the streets and activism and things, all things activist and associated as such, Roger Hickey is with us. He is the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, an organization launched by about 100 of prominent Americans to expand the national debate about America's economic future. The campaign seeks to empower working Americans, middle-class family. Well, you know, instead of my reading, tell us about it. Roger Hickey, welcome to the program.
The organization is along the same lines as your new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War on the Middle Class and Fighting Back. So that's what we're all about.
And you're all about fighting back.
And you do it much better than Lou Dobbs does.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Although, you know, he's doing it for a Republican. He's not doing a too bad a job. But still has that baggage.
Right.
In any case, the Campaign for America's Future, a great progressive organization. You had a conference a while ago. I was broadcasting live from
that
conference.
We hope you come back
well.
This June, too.
I look forward to it.
Good.
I would love to. What is your top priority right now at the Campaign for America's Future?
Well, we've got, first of all, to make the new Congress a success, and we have been working with lots of other groups to help Nancy Pelosi pass her first 100 hours agenda.
Yeah.
Now, we regard that as a down payment on some big changes that have to be made, and we've got a big Apollo Energy coalition with labor and environmentalists to really get independent of foreign oil. But also, healthcare is going to be one of our big priorities.
Right.
Now is the time, when even the president acknowledges that there's a crisis, now is the time for progressives to be out there with a plan and a vision for how we cover everybody without letting the health insurance industry dominate the next expansion of health care.
Yeah.
We're for social insurance. We're not for the private insurance companies. And so we are promoting a nationwide discussion of how do we insure everybody when we have a crisis driven by the fact that the insurance companies only want to insure the wealthy, the healthy, and the people that don't really need health insurance.
Right. It's like the old joke about banks. You know, they don't want you when you need them, and when you don't need them, then they're all excited
about
you.
Very true of the health insurance industry, too.
Yeah.
So we think that it's great that Schwarzenegger in California and the Massachusetts health care plan are all creating this big upsurge in discussion about health care. But all those plans really depend on subsidizing the private insurance industry.
Right, which is like my phrase for it is it's a leech on the back of our body politic. I mean, they are sucking hundreds of billions of dollars out of the United States for absolutely no good purpose.
Unhealthy even for our big companies who are trying to be competitive against other countries where they nationalize the cost of health care.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're promoting a plan. We're promoting a plan by Jacob Hacker, a guy who's got a new book out there, too, called The Great Risk Shift. His plan would create a Medicare-like plan system for the rest of us.
Right.
So that if the federal government gets in the business of trying to cover everybody, which we think it should, we should be subsidizing a public entity that has the ability to control prices and will insure everybody, whether they're healthy.
Why not simply say everybody can sign up for Medicare?
Well, that's basically the idea. Medicare is designed for elderly people, so they don't have they don't take care of childbirth and those kind of things.
But you have to change it, obviously. But I mean, you know, why not just simply say Medicare for all, like Ted Kennedy said the other day?
Well, that's the theme. That's the theme that we're all talking about now.
Yeah.
Hacker's plan would do two parallel systems that would work together to control costs, and would gradually converge. The other way to do it is just enrich the Medicare benefit right now and put everybody into it.
Right. Roger Hickey, co-director, is that it?
Yeah.
Of the Center for America's Future, ourfuture.org is your
website. Ourfuture.org.
As I recall. Yeah.
Yep.
And are you guys going to be involved at all in the protests on Saturday?
We are. We're part of this big new coalition of a lot of the groups that normally work on domestic issues have just decided, well, this is too important.
Yeah.
The Alliance Against the Iraq Escalation, really, is what they're doing, not a surge, but an escalation. So we're very much a part of trying to pressure the Congress to do what the Senate has begun to do, to get troops back and redeployed and stop the surge, which, if we don't do something, could go on for the rest of the Bush presidency.
Yeah, the Foreign Relations Committee, I believe it is, yesterday voted one Republican defected.
Yes. Senator Hagel.
Senator Hagel. But all the rest of the Republicans are still in Bush's camp. It's
well,
this
on that
is
committee,
even non-binding.
On that committee, next going to go to the full Senate, and there we're going to see a number of Republican senators vote for the resolution. Yeah. So
you know, what's interesting is that with regard to the war, we're seeing the Senate really is out front. They're really out front on this, to the extent that, you know, I mean, I'd like to see them a whole lot more out front, but nonetheless. But with regard to Nancy Pelosi's agenda that she passed in the House, she, you know, part of that was raising the minimum wage. The Republicans this morning in the Senate blew it up.
Yep. They want to hang all kinds of so-called pro-business tax cuts on this very simple increase in the minimum wage.
Right.
And a lot of the people who are doing these amendments have also voted to abolish the minimum wage altogether. This is double talk and real cynicism. They know that the American people are 85-90% in favor of raising the minimum wage.
Sure.
So they know it's going to pass. They know that probably Bush is going to have to sign it, and they're trying to load it down with all kinds of other amendments.
Are they going to succeed?
It's hard to tell, but now is the time for people to chime in with their members of Congress and their senators, especially if you have a Republican senator.
Right.
They need to feel a lot of heat, and we will see. Some kind of minimum wage increase is going to pass, The question whether it is whether it'll be encumbered with all kinds of expensive tax breaks for business.
Yeah. We're talking with Roger Hickey, the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, the website. Roger, what are the other issues that you're working on now?
Well, we're trying to popularize the idea of public investment.
You know, that just that phrase, investment rather than expense. I mean, the Republicans have spent 26 years trying and really re-educated a generation, tragically de-educated a generation, from away from the idea of government, much government spending actually being investment as opposed to expense.
Yep.
And redefined it all as expense. I mean, it's incredible. So just to hear you use that, it just made my heart.
Yeah, well,
go pitter-patter,
you know. The country is a big country,
yeah.
And we have big, big challenges. Poverty is growing. The infrastructure that we used to think was 21st century, now in the 21st century, we're falling apart. If we want to be a prosperous country, and if we want to be high-tech, and we want to have a workforce that is productive, we've got to invest in those things.
Yeah.
And as you point out, the Republicans, through their tax cuts, have really dismantled the federal government. So it always falls to the Democrats, if they get back in power, to go through this cleanup process of trying to get back to where we were, just to get out of the deficit that they left us.
Yeah, the two Santa Claus theory.
What we're trying to do is convince everybody running for president that there are some other priorities besides balancing the budget and cleaning up after the Republicans. We've got to invest in the country.
Yeah, although there's nothing wrong with balancing the budget, too. Clinton pulled it off.
Nothing wrong with balancing the budget. Unfortunately, Bill Clinton kept on after he had balanced the budget, starting retiring the debt instead of investing in the country.
Mm.
And that's the danger that we want to avoid this time around.
Yeah.
There are some things more important than balancing the budget, and one of them is investing in our future.
Yeah. Well, in many ways, Bill Clinton was, I would argue, more conservative than Dwight Eisenhower, for example. Not to say that Dwight Eisenhower was a great liberal, but
right.
I don't think most people get that. You know, Bill Clinton, he was a good guy, and he did a lot of good things.
And it's time to bring us back to health care, which he tried and failed. Now the country wants the government involved in the health care, and it's time to make sure that when we get a Democratic president, it's got a health care plan that people understand and be part of.
Yeah, and in order to do that, we the people are going to have to be heard by these people. It's not a matter of just sitting back. It's not a matter of watching the talking heads on TV. It's not a matter of it's a matter of letting the candidates know. They all have websites. They're all looking for feedback. Let them know. Healthcare should be a right, not a privilege. Dennis Kucinich has said it. Barack Obama has said it. We have a couple. It wouldn't surprise me if John Edwards has said it. I haven't looked on his website. I understand Hillary Clinton may be preparing to say it if she hasn't already. This meme needs to be the absolute norm in this country.
The next 2 years, we have a lot of leverage over who the next president is going to be and what the next president is going to do if we mobilize and put our pressure on.
There you go. Well said. Roger Hickey is the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, the website. Roger, thanks for being with us today.
Good to be here.
Great
thanks.
Talking with you. It's 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be right back.
I stoke the mighty furnaces and roll the flaming steel. I operated oil rigs and wells. And when the country needed them, I built the planes and tanks to send the tyrants down to fry in hell. I'm the man that built the bridges. I'm the man that laid the track. I'm the man that built this country with my shoulders and my back. I'm the man that built the power dams and oiled all the fires. And I laid down the cornerstone for this great land of ours.
And welcome back. Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. On the Tom Hartman Radio Program, broadcasting live from the Families USA Conference here in Washington, D.C., getting ready for the big protest march on Saturday. Should be great fun. A lot of an enormous amount of energy around this thing. It's remarkable, frankly, just remarkable. And a lot in the news today as well. Some quick summaries. Senate conservatives yesterday blocked legislation to raise the federal minimum wage from $5.15 to $7.52. Oh, my. and insisting that it include new tax breaks for restaurants and other businesses. Congressional Budget Office reports yesterday that President Bush can do one or the other. He can either have his tax breaks or he can have a balanced budget. He can't do both. So we'll see how that shakes out. Congressman Frank Pallone is with us, representing the people of the 6th District of New Jersey. Congressman Pallone, welcome.
Hi, thank you. How you doing?
Great to have you with us. Sir, you issued a statement on President Bush's State of the Union address. You're the chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, Subcommittee on Health. I'm curious about your take on particularly with regard to health care. But broadly, any issues on this that you want to talk about? What are your thoughts on the State of the Union address?
Well, I was disappointed with the health care parts in particular, because even though the president was talking about covering the uninsured and saying that, you know, we need to address the issue, and that was good, but the problem is his proposal is a non-starter because it won't accomplish the goal. And basically what he does is tax people who have pretty good health insurance, and then, you know, give a tax break to people who would go into the individual market and buy health insurance. But as you know, the individual market does not have a lot of opportunities, particularly for people who, you know, need a good policy because they're sick or they're older. And I just want to accomplish the goal of getting a lot more people insured. And it might have the negative consequence of putting an additional tax burden on those who have good insurance. I don't think it accomplishes the goal.
You've been in Congress, sir, for, what, 20 years?
Almost. This is my 19th year.
Harry Truman, in 1947, first proposed a national health care system, basically a Medicare for all system. It's, you know, we've gone through all these variations, all these permutations. What's it going to take?
Well, I mean, I'd like to see a single-payer system, but I just don't think politically it can happen, you know, with right now. I mean, we, you know, the Democrats are in the majority, but we have just a slim majority, and I think it would be hard to get support for that. So what I've been saying is, let's address the uninsured from two perspectives. One, for those who are working, to create an incentive for employers to provide health insurance by making it cheaper for them. Either give them a tax break or take something off the table, like have the government pay for catastrophic costs so that they can, it won't cost the employer as much to provide health insurance. And then secondly, expand the existing government programs like Medicaid or the family care for kids so that more people would qualify than qualify right now. And you'd cover a lot of the uninsured if you accomplish those two goals.
The camel's nose under the tent theory.
What's that?
The camel's nose under the tent theory. Let's get started. You know, let's start eating away at this thing, and eventually there'll be a consensus.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you probably have the largest group of children, so if you expanded the kid care program, which we started a few years ago, you could probably double the amount of kids that are covered.
Right. But aren't the health insurance company, I mean, in my opinion, we have an entire industry that, frankly, has no purpose for existence. And is sucking hundreds of billions of dollars out of the healthcare system in the United States and harming this country in the process. Aren't they going to do everything that they can to weasel their way into this thing and either get their hooks in such a way that they can never be disengaged or destroy these programs? I mean, won't there come a time when politicians are going to have to say, this is, you know, we're going to confront this industry?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the bottom line is we have an opportunity now, you know, with divided government to try to come up with a consensus across party lines. And, you know, the one thing I always say, Tom, is just not be ideological. Let's try to find some practical way of covering as many people as possible when you talk about health insurance. And then probably the best thing is to build on existing programs. You know, most people get the health insurance through their employer, and the employers are not covering people because they can't afford it. So you got to figure out a way to make it cheaper for the employer. That's not the individual market. You know, that's a very small group. It doesn't really matter as much. You have to address the employer.
But we're the only country in the world that even involves the employer in the equation. I mean, Toyota decided to site a factory in Canada simply because there was more health care cost than steel cost in an automobile.
Yeah. Well, Senator Kerry had a proposal in the last election where he was going to have the government cover catastrophic costs. You know, like I think You know, if you had to pay out, say, more than $50,000 for a particular incident.
What is responsible for about half of all bankruptcies, by the way?
And basically, when you talk to the employers, they say, well, you know, that's a big boost for us. If the government covered that, then we wouldn't have as much of a problem providing health insurance.
Uh-huh. So where is that going to go?
Well, I mean, I just use that as an example. I don't think that's something to look at.
It's a reasonable starting point,
To boost up the employer-sponsored system and then look at expanding things like SCHIP. We're going to have hearings on the SCHIP, which is a kid care program, in about 2 weeks to try to figure out a way to expand that. And I think that has a lot of support amongst Republicans, too.
Great. Well, I wish you well, sir, in your efforts, and thank you very much for being with us on the program.
All right, Tom. Thanks.
Congressman Frank Pallone, Jr., representing the people of the 6th District of New Jersey. It's 57 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program. We're going to have, let's see here, Susan Turnbull is going to be with us, the vice chair of the Democratic National Committee, right after the break.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Susan Turnbull is with us. She was elected vice chair of the Democratic National Committee in 2005. Democrats.org, of course, the official website for the official Democratic Party. And Susan, number two to Howard Dean, would that be a way of describing it?
That's a good way to describe it.
Yeah.
It's,
how is it working with Howard Dean?
It's great, actually.
He doesn't scream a lot.
No.
No, of course not. No. I knew him
actually,
as governor of Vermont. He's a great guy.
Yeah, and one of the things that's been so great is that this year we have a lot to be, if you're going to scream, we could be screaming about the fact that we really do have a 50-state strategy. We have a strong Democratic Party all across the country, and we have a new Speaker of the House named Nancy Pelosi, and a majority leader versus minority leader. It feels good.
Yeah, it's marvelous stuff. I mean, the last time we talked, I think that this was almost a distant dream.
I think that's right.
It really was. I'm curious what... You said we have a 50-state strategy. It was one of the first things you mentioned. And, of course, that's Howard Dean's baby. I mean, you know, he really, really believed in that. And yet the Democratic Leadership Council, Rahm Emanuel, and Rahm's no longer the head of it, but, you know, you had a bunch of folks, for that matter, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, were, if not actively sabotaging it, it sure looked that way to those of us in the media.
You know,
what's going on inside the Democratic Party right now?
It was really interesting, Tom. Obviously, I think there was just misunderstanding there. From the point that what we were hoping for with the 50-state strategy is that we would have a floor. We would have an opportunity where all of the state parties would raise up, and so that they would have full-time staff, they would have field organizers, and that they would have an ability to really mount campaigns and to identify candidates for campaigns. At the same time, the DCCC and the DFCC were very very directed in the way that they should be towards electing candidates for 2006. We were working together. If you talk to a congressional candidate in Ohio or a congressional candidate in New Hampshire, or if you talk to someone across the country where we had winning candidates, they'll say the DNC field organizers were critical in their elections. And I think that's a good thing. And I think that we're moving forward. We've had success. I know that Governor Dean and Chris Van Hollen, our new chair of the DCCC, are working together on recruitment so that we can move ahead with recruiting candidates.
Well, and Chris Van Hollen is a progressive.
Oh, absolutely. Chris is my congressman. I live in Chris's district, and Chris is actually working right now on the issue of bundling so that there's identification and transparency as to who makes contributions. Mm. It's a little unusual for the head of a campaign committee to be out there on this kind of ethics reform, and it's because he is such a great progressive.
Are we seeing, Susan? We're talking about Susan Turnbull, who's the vice chair of the Democratic National Committee. Vice chair, right? Yeah, vice chair. Are we seeing the Democratic Party returning to its roots in the Roosevelt era? It just seems that it had strayed so far, not so far away from that, but from Clinton forward, it seemed that the Democratic Party was getting more and more Republican-lite. I hope I'm not offending you,
it's sort of funny because I know my views have never changed, and my colleagues on the DNC who are elected in their states and represent national organizations, all of us have been grassroots Democrats. That's what we really are. And what you saw, and I think one of the reasons you're bringing this up is that when we were in power, now that we're in power in the Congress, we can do the things that we've always wanted to do because it's realistic and it's possible. We can, and we did in 100 days, in the first 100 hours, pass...
For 70-some hours.
Yeah, for 70-some hours, pass minimum wage... to raise the minimum wage.
Right.
We passed...
Although the Senate just...
The Senate is not on the Democratic side, but on the Republican side, and hopefully we'll be able to work that out and so we can move this quickly.
You were going through the list of things
you passed. Going through the list... We did ethics reform, which is really important, and it's overreaching on everything. We worked together to make sure that we could lower prescription drug costs by allowing our government and through the program to negotiate prices for prescription drugs for the Medicare Part D.
What a radical idea.
What a radical idea.
Oh, my God. They're going to negotiate prescription drug
prices.
We can't allow that.
Yes. And we also work to make college more affordable by lowering interest rates on college loans.
Yes.
These are things that are progressive ideas. These are things that people wanted and asked for because it affects their everyday life and their families and their futures. And I think that what you're going to see is there going to be more and more of that.
I think you can make a strong argument, though, that what brought about the middle class in the United States in the 20th century, because it pretty much didn't exist for most of the 19th century. You had the robber barons and you had the working poor, and basically the only middle class from around 1830 until around 1930 were small family farmers and people who owned small businesses, and that was about it. It was a large class of the working poor in the United States. And the thing that brought about the modern middle class was two things. It was the Wagner Act in 1935, unionization, and which the Republicans started to deconstruct with Taft-Hartley in 47. And the GI Bill. You had an entire generation of Americans. I opened my book Screwed with the story of my dad, who, served 2 years in Japan and came back and on the GI Bill was going to go to college. He wanted to become a college professor. That free college education, access to health care as a result of a good union job, access to a pension as a result of a good union job. These were the things that built the American middle class that was so powerful as an economic and ultimately as a political force in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s. And they are the things that have been deconstructed ever since Reagan came into power in 81. There's been a 26-year war against the American middle class. And it's only occasionally, frankly, that I hear the Democratic Party as a party. I hear a lot of individual Democrats, but certainly not across the board, that I hear the Democratic Party as a party talking about those things, talking about those core issues, about let's repeal Taft-Hartley, or I never hear the Democratic Party talking about that, but some Democrats will. Let's go back to the notions of the GI Bill, only instead of having to have a world war as an excuse for it, we've already demonstrated it works, to say, hey, anybody can have a free college education with our tax dollars, because for every $10,000 we invest in somebody going to college, we're going to make $100,000 in income taxes as a result of their having that education over the next 40 years. This is not expense. It's investment. You know, where is the Democratic Party with these issues that literally did, and again, in health care, the topic of this conference, national health care system. Harry Truman introduced this in 1947. You know, the Republicans, of course, wouldn't let it even get to a vote, but, you know.
Tom, I think this election showed that there is a difference and that people really do pay attention to those issues. Sherrod Brown is going to be one of the speakers at the conference this afternoon, and Sherrod is a progressive's progressive. I mean,
yeah.
And as far as middle class issues, his entire campaign in the state of Ohio was based on taking care and winning the election for the middle class,
right,
and a stronger middle class. And I think that you're going to see that in a lot of the candidates that were elected. People like Amy Klobuchar and Claire McCaskill are bringing a new breath of fresh air to the United States Senate and new members of Congress in the same way. You have a bunch of veterans who are here and are now going to bring the sense of, this is what I gave to my country, and we should be doing better by our veterans. And I think that all those are middle-class progressive issues, and I think that having the ability to set the agenda is what's going to make the difference.
Yeah. Well, I think it's absolutely marvelous that you and Howard Dean and people who, in my opinion, have a very positive vision of America are leading the DNC. Do you feel at risk? Do you feel that the forces of, quote, moderates, that is Republican light, might be creeping up on you?
No, I don't. I think, for example, I'm introducing a resolution at the DNC meeting on the issue of Darfur.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's going to pass unanimously.
Yeah.
That is a progressive issue. That is something that is something we as world citizens need to pay attention to. We have a resolution dealing supporting our troops at the same time against escalation of this war.
Yeah, great. Susan Turnbull, she is the vice chair of the Democratic National Committee, Democrats.org, the website for the official DNC website. Susan, thanks for being with us here.
Great
today.
To be with you,
and,
Tom.
And thanks for showing up here at the conference. It's great to have you here. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Lonely feeling deep inside. Find a corner where I can hide. Silent footsteps crowding me. Sudden darkness, but I can see.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you.
Eating the remnants of my apple at the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to answer, no, I don't think so. John Bauman is with us. He is the director of the advocacy at the Sergeant Shriver National Center on Poverty Law. Povertylaw.org is the website. And we're here at the Families USA Conference in Washington, D.C., broadcasting live from the Mayflower Hotel, where 6 o'clock tonight, by the way, I'll be doing a book signing for folks who want to come by and a good rant about the middle class.
I'll be there.
Cool. Great. I look forward to it. John, the Sergeant Shriver National Center on Poverty Law. First of all, I'm guessing that many of our listeners are just broadly not familiar with that. Give us a snapshot.
It's a law office that does develops policies and does advocacy and communications around ideas that help people escape poverty, help them enter the middle class, and once they're there, help them stay there.
How?
Well, one of the classic issues that bridges both of those economic groups is health insurance. If you have it, you have one part of the important equipment to be economically upwardly mobile, in addition to being healthy.
Right.
Details.
Yeah.
And if you don't have it, you're deeply at risk because of medical bills, because of inability to get preventive care, to develop a relationship with a doctor and so on. That all starts with coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And health insurance is one of the big important issues of sort of the infrastructure of economic mobility. Very impressed right now that you can feel it at this conference with the politics of this issue. I think the people at kitchen tables are way ahead of the politicians on this. And it's starting to dawn on people that it's not only safe to talk about coverage for everybody in America, but it's actually politically useful to do so.
Yeah.
And
Americans
you might be in trouble if you don't think about it.
Yeah, I think Americans have had enough.
Yeah, I think so, too. Even the people with insurance, I assume you do, I do, we're worried about it all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Healthcare is still too expensive.
Half of all bankruptcies are the consequence of people getting sick.
Right.
And more than half of those people were fully insured at the time they got sick.
That's right.
And they ended up declaring bankruptcy anyway.
Right.
And which is no small thing.
And just the monthly cost of the premium and the co-payments and so on. It's more and more businesses can't afford to stay in it, and you know, so it's a crisis, and I think finally we're going to get some action on it.
Yeah, and we're finding companies, American companies as well as other companies that might otherwise invest in the United States, all over the world, saying, you know, no, we're not going to participate in manufacturing, for example, in the United States. Toyota just siting a factory from Alabama up to Montreal because they didn't want to pay the health care costs.
Right.
We have a health care system that is paid for by employers by and large. And no other country in the world does. And people look at us and go, what are you guys, nuts?
Well, as Senator Obama noted this morning, he was a keynoter here, American cars have twice as much health care in the car as their foreign competitors.
Right.
And so that's the Ford is struggling and so on. It needs to be dealt with. And the first step, the easy step, very doable step right now is to cover all the children in America.
And how do we do that?
Well, of all the uninsured, almost 50 million, 9 million are children. But of those 9, 6 million are already covered by the state children's health insurance program, but they're not enrolled yet. And so investment
they're
in enrollment. Yeah,
yeah,
they're eligible.
So.
And then so it's a modest step beyond that to get all the children.
Yeah.
It's a very big idea, but it's a very small cost. It's a very doable thing.
Yeah.
You won't hear any opposition to it head on.
Right.
Nobody's going to stand up and say, gee, there's too many kids with health insurance.
Right.
But what they'll say is indirectly they'll talk about, indirectly, that's right, they'll talk about the budget deficit and the,
can we afford this?
The proper role for government.
We've got to preserve our health, our tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, you know.
That's
it's,
right.
It's very, very important.
We have a self-imposed budget crisis.
Yes, yes. And so we're talking with John Bauman of Poverty Law, the Sergeant Shriver National Center for Poverty Law, povertylaw.org, the website. John, we just have a few seconds left, but what can people, individual people, our listeners, do to get involved? And for that matter, is there any way that they can support your organization, the work that you're doing?
There's a great way to do that right on our website. Thank you very much.
Povertylaw.org.
Povertylaw.org. I think the thing that people can help with in terms of getting this health insurance business taken care of is to sound off, to keep the pressure on the politicians who are beginning to detect it finally. But just keep that activity. And when a credible plan arises to cover everybody in America, get all over it and insist that your representatives support it too.
Yeah.
This year, I think the message is cover all kids. Don't wait. Doesn't have to be next year. Do it this year. Do it now.
Yeah. And a simple first step. And then I'd say the second step is Medicare for all and we're done. But, there's a million variations.
There's a lot of conversations about the actual how to do it.
Yeah.
But I think the debate is over about whether to do it.
Yeah. Well said. John Bauman, povertylaw.org, the website, the Sergeant Shriver National Center of Poverty Law, the panelist here at the Children USA Conference. 27 minutes past the hour.
Oh, but ain't that America? You and me. Ain't that America? Something to see, baby. Ain't that America? Home on the free. Yeah.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Families USA Conference in Washington, D.C. And our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into the live chat room. And I am in there. Actually, I can even access it with my laptop here at the conference. And we have a couple of Cheney clips that are particularly outrageous. I want to share them with you in just a moment. First, let's take a couple of phone calls. A few people have been waiting for a while. Robert in Berkeley, California. Hey, Robert, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. I'm a retired physician, and I feel there's it's good to hear some of the comments on national health insurance. But one that should be made is that we should eliminate insurance, not to have these as paying for insurance.
Yes, I agree. I think that health insurance companies have no reason to exist in the United States.
That's my point, and thank you for hearing it.
Okay. Thank you, Robert. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. And to know that a retired doc feels the same way. Will in South Park, Colorado. Hey, Will. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Truth Teller. How you doing, man?
I'm fine. What's up?
I was bummed because I thought at the last minute I could be there with you guys. I wanted to bring you a T-shirt and everything, man. But I can't be there. You got to be screaming for me on Saturday, man. I heard
well,
you'd be big.
I will be. I'd be amazed, Will, if there's not also a demonstration on Saturday in Denver.
Oh, dude, well, I'm totally here for anything that's going on, but
yeah,
I mean, I was planning on being there.
Out.
I was there five times over the last couple of years, so
yeah.
I'm kind of bummed I can't be there when they're saying there's more than 10 people this time. I'll be darned. I wonder if it'll be on the regular news if there's more than 10 people there saying,
you know,
it's
amazing. It's like the more people there are, the less likely it's going to be covered by the mainstream media, you know. It's
funny how that works. And do you think the brown shirts are getting ready to build up their little private army? I mean, man, I tell you, it's time to be able to say Nazi like fascist. I'm pretty sure even the Young Turks would agree with me at this point.
Yeah.
Go
ahead.
Have a great one, man.
Okay.
Thanks a lot,
Will. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call. Got an email from somebody saying maybe Bush's private army is going to do the same thing that he's doing now with our national army, which is to say to people who are not citizens of the United States, hey, if you'd like to get citizenship, all you have to do is come over and die for us. It's amazing. I mean, it's really amazing that we have army recruiting offices outside the United States. We have army recruiting offices in other countries, particularly in the South and Central America, saying if you'd like to become a U.S. citizen, all you have to do is join the army. Could it be that the brown shirts, the private army that George W. Bush is suggesting putting together, the civilian army corps, will be coming from other nations as well? Who knows? Chris in Taos, New Mexico. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I really enjoy you. I'm on the fringe of KTRC down in Santa Fe.
Mm-hmm. Great. Glad to hear you can hear the signal. So what's up?
Barely. It's either that I can listen to Al Franken on the local, and I like Al, but I like you better.
Well, thank you.
Anyway.
Al's a good guy, too.
Oh, he is. Yes, absolutely. I've been looking at this this problem, and the awakening is what has to happen. I'm sure you're tuned right in on that.
Yes. Well, that's my parade theory, that it's not politicians who are going to save us. It's not the political process. It's not the political parties. There's no, you know, this whole salvationist mindset that something external to us is going to save us has permeated our society, probably because it also permeates several of our religions. And the bottom line is that we're the ones who have to save us.
That's true, yeah.
You know, it's the more Buddhist worldview, I guess, than the revealed religion ones. And
yeah, there's only one life, and life divides, and that's us.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, duh.
Yeah, let's get out there and let's get active.
Yeah, so. And what I wanted to recommend was a book called The World Peace Diet by Will Tuttle.
Uh-huh.
And he goes and gives us a lot of understanding of the implications of our food choices. I'm kind of reading this off the back of the book just so I can say it. He's got the universal principles that really don't deny any religious tradition that doesn't have a judgmental God that's going to punish you, which doesn't seem to make any sense to me.
Yeah.
The other book that I just finished reading is called The Divine Matrix by Greg Braden. And again, he's got a worldview that's inclusive and loving and kind. And the last one I want to just mention here for you and all your listeners is a book called The God Theory by Bernard Haisch, H-A-I-S-C-H. And he's cut to really clear. He's a scientist kind of guy.
Yeah.
And he's really, you know, bitching about how the science religion guys, the religion of science guys, are in total denial about anything that is non-material, quote-unquote.
Right. Like back in the 19th century. What? Somebody talk over through the air? That's not possible. We need to have wires for that.
Yes, I know. But I think what we can do is simply just open ourselves up to each other and attempt to at least accept, if not actually love each other, by being kind, by sharing and cooperating. And most of these religions and most of the politicians, well, they'll just go by the by
yeah.
the way.
Well, actually, you know, most of the religions were founded in that as a concept, and our political structure in the United States was founded with that as a concept. Chris, thank you for the call and for the recommendations. By the way, John Robbins, an old friend of mine, the heir to the Baskin-Robbins family, who pretty much walked away from it, actually, has written several brilliant books on diet and on living lightly and simply, and in fact, in the first edition of The Prophet's Way, I had some quotes from him on just, you know, how much water goes into a pound of beef and how much food goes into it and how many people could be fed if more people were vegetarian, things like that. You know, without going into a whole rant, there is the concept of a peace diet is a very real thing. Jude in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jude, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning, Tom. I wanted to ask first if maybe when you're at the demonstrations, if your sweet wife might hold some white flowers with the intention of women standing and just be a vessel for peace.
Yeah, except that she's back in Portland.
Oh, she's well. Maybe she can do that there.
Maybe she can do that there, yes.
Well, I wanted to bring up, I heard an excerpt last night on C-SPAN 3, which I don't get here, and it was the interchange with, there were many of senators, it was Kennedy and Reed, and it was especially Reed. He was questioning the lieutenant colonel that replaced Casey.
Yes.
And they were talking about the projected need for 100,000 troops. And they talked about the 21,000 of ours that are supposed to go and then about 40,000 of the Iraqi. And he says that the additional 40, he says, my understanding is going to be the contractors. And he said, is it Blackwell that you're going to be pulling in? And the lieutenant colonel said, well, we're going to be using a portion of private contractors to be able to, you know, secure certain sites around Iraq. And I went back into thinking about during the State of the Union address when Bush talked about the voluntary army.
Right. Yeah. And moving from professional mercenaries, for lack of a better word, although as we said yesterday, I know the Blackwater wouldn't describe themselves as that, but basically moving from existing corporations who are providing that service to having the government create an institution that would provide that.
Oh, absolutely.
Non-military service. And I think it's just fraught with danger. Even if Wesley Clark came up with the original idea, I can't believe that it will be implemented in a way that would be as rational and reasonable as anything that Wesley Clark would do if it was done by the Bush administration.
Well, if it was any other time in history, you know, I might not have as many concerns, but I worry for our country. How could that not be easily turned against any of us?
Yeah,
and, but anyway, thanks so much for everything, Tom.
Thank you, June. I'm right there with you, and I totally agree. We've got a couple of clips of Dick Cheney. It's really quite remarkable. Wolf Blitzer interviewed Dick Cheney, and in two different places, Cheney got a little over the top. This first one, I believe, is when he asked about Dick Cheney's daughter. If you have that, if you can play that, Andrew from New York.
What the Jim Webb, the senator from Virginia, said in his Democratic response last night.
Okay. What happened? Go ahead and play it. We'll see what it is.
What the Jim Webb, the senator from Virginia, said in his Democratic response last night.
The president took us into this war recklessly. We are now, as a nation, held hostage to the predictable and predicted disarray that has followed.
And it's not just Jim Webb. It's some of your good Republican friends in the Senate and the House are now seriously questioning your credibility because of the blunders of the failures. Gordon Smith.
Wolf.
Hogwash.
Wolf. I simply don't accept the premise of your question. I just think it's hogwash.
It's hogwash. It's all hogwash.
The president himself says there were
remember me. Now, the critics have not suggested a policy. They haven't put anything in place. All they want to do, all they've recommended is to redeploy or to withdraw our forces. The fact is we can complete the task in Iraq. We're going to do it. We've got Petraeus, General Petraeus, taking over. It is a good strategy. It will work, but we have to have the stomach to finish the task.
What if the Senate passes a resolution saying this is not a good idea? Will that stop you?
It won't stop us, and it would be, I think, detrimental from the standpoint of the troops, as General Petraeus said yesterday. He was asked by Joe Lieberman, among others, in his testimony, about this notion that somehow the Senate could vote overwhelmingly for him, send him on his new assignment, and then pass a resolution at the same time and say, but we don't agree with the mission you've been given.
So you're moving forward no matter what the Congress does.
We are moving forward.
To hell with Congress.
we're the Bush administration. We don't care what the representatives of the people think. Amazing. Dick Cheney. It's hogwash. People criticizing me. Hogwash. That's one mighty big hog. 45 minutes past the hour. 866-440-8466. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. We'll be back with more news of the day and your calls right after this.
Thunder on the mountain and the stars on the moon. The rubbish in the alley and the summer will be here soon. Today's the day you're gonna grab my trombone blue. Well, it's hot stuff here and it's everywhere I go.
I was
thinking about the Lisa Keys.
Welcome back to Tom Hartman Radio Program, the True People's Radio. 9.5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Leonard in Phoenix, Arizona on the line. Hey, Leonard, welcome to the program.
Welcome, sir, and I always learn so much from your show, and I just want to thank you for being a beacon for the truth. I'm calling basically...
Well, thank you. Tag, you're it. Pass it on.
You're right. I am it, and I'm trying to do something about that, Mr. Hartman. I really appreciate it. I'm calling because, you know, I did get back from Iraq in February of last year. And my amazing thoughts that I'm having are, why are our generals, our leadership generals like Petraeus, you know, knowing full well that this mission is not going to be accomplished for a theocratic, corrupt government. I was there. I worked as an MP every day going outside of the wire. I went to the Green Zone, went to different parts of Baghdad, and I saw for myself, Mr. Hartman, that from the Iraqi police that we worked with, all the way up to their government, how corrupt they were. And we as soldiers were just trying to survive every day. We had interpreters working with us, Iraqi interpreters, and some of them are very good people, but so desperate for money, I'm convinced we're taking bribes with cell phones. Everybody has cell phones. We only knew that it seems like the enemy knew where we were going to be. Even the Iraqi police would mysteriously disappear from checkpoints where a bomb would go off shortly thereafter. And so I'm just amazed that our generals, our leadership, are selling out their men, and as far as I'm concerned, they're selling out their oaths to the Constitution. They somehow think they must support a president who's become a king rather than the Constitution.
Well, you know, an awful lot of them, Leonard, have chosen not to. This is absolutely unprecedented as far as I know. It didn't even happen during Vietnam. You have this large number of high-ranking senior military officials. You know, from the rank of lieutenant colonel all the way up to general and multiple star generals who are taking early retirement.
That's good to hear.
So that they can speak out. There was a number of them who did, about 6 months ago, there was like five of them all at once as these kinds of policies were coming down the road. I mean, there's been a number of people who have sacrificed their careers and given up a good chunk of their retirement in order to be able to speak
well,
out.
Well, it sure would, Mr. Hartman, be good to hear somebody like Petraeus or somebody now who could say, I will do my mission, but I don't agree with it, like some of the British generals actually did while on duty. But our generals think that if they speak out while they're still on active service, that for having an opinion, they'll be considered traitors.
Well, they will be prosecuted. I mean, look at what's happening to Aaron Wintada. One of the things,
exactly.
You know, he's not just being prosecuted for not deploying to Iraq. He's also being prosecuted for speaking out, for conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman.
Right. Well, for not wanting to commit war crimes and following the laws of humanity, you now have our soldiers being tried, and people like Bush and Dick Cheney, you should be ashamed of yourselves. I personally watched two of my friends die and other people get wounded because of your lie having us in Iraq. So thank you, Mr. Hartman. Please keep up the fight. I'm it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Leonard. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Tom. Hey, we've got a thing going on called the People's Cafe that we participate in, peoplescafe.us, the website.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been interesting. There are a lot of activists that show up at these. And one thing is happening now is there's a hell of a lot of burnout. People are tired of being the only dozen people that keep showing up for each issue.
Sure.
And it was read, and I last week we had an aide to one of the city council members attend, and she was saying, you know, what really makes a difference is getting new people, new faces. It's like even if people have a great argument, they come before the city council. If you're the same old faces, they don't listen. And so
right.
It's amazing after all these years that we still only have a small amount of people active.
Well, I think that's always been the case, Jeff. I think that's
I'm just letting
from the founding of this country to today.
The people are really active or are really burned out. But it also, having met with people at all levels of government, aides and so forth, we find frequently the aides are the most knowledgeable and many times the most influential people. They really can influence what the representative does. And so I want people to consider, go apply for a job as an assistant to a legislator.
Hmm. That's interesting.
I think that is honestly one of the most effective things somebody can do, because the legislators have no time to get educated. The
yeah.
aides do the education.
Yeah, and very often the aides are running the show. But isn't there a particular kind of hierarchy or pecking order transitional process where people become aides? I mean, aren't they usually drawn from people who have before been interns or people who have,
not necessarily.
They just hire people off the street.
Some of the people have come from the active, have come from organizations that are active. Mm-hmm. It just depends what level of government, because it's, there are election commissioners who need assistance. There are county clerks. There are city council people, county commissioners, and so forth.
Yeah.
And
just start local.
Yeah, so it goes at all levels like that. So, yes, some come from... Yeah, there is a hierarchy, but others, it is just people off the street or people they become familiar with.
Interesting. Great suggestion. Yeah. Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, and the other thing is we're still lacking candidates. There's, it's amazing, again, with all these problems people see in the world, that people aren't stepping up. Like in Denver, we have a city councilman that virtually everybody thinks is awful, but he's running unopposed.
Hmm.
And so if anybody's interested running for city council in South Denver, we need somebody.
Wow. Wow, how do you get that word out? How do you reach out to back in the old days, I guess the local wards and the Democratic wards and things, back when people lived in at least in urban areas, people knew the politicians. There was a relationship. Sometimes there was a corrupt relationship, but there was a relationship. These days, it seems like we're all disconnected from it.
Yeah, and we just see it all over the place at almost every level of the parties. Of the lower levels of government, many times it's hard to find candidates.
Yeah. So the starting pad, I would think, is to show up for your local Democratic Party meetings, show up for the Green Party meetings, show up for the Republican Party, whatever you're inclined to do. Start showing up at the local meetings. Yeah.
Yep.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from
you. Take care.
Bye. You too. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting for a Change in America. After the news at the top of the hour, we'll be covering the news of the day, taking your calls, and at 20 minutes past the hour, Yance Sheldon is going
to be with us. You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, there's two huge stories out there that I think are worthy of note. Welcome back to the program, by the way. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour. The first, Dick Cheney, raw story breaking this. The escalation of U.S. military planning on Iran. Excuse me, it is only the latest chess move in a six-year push within the Bush administration to attack Iran, a raw story investigation has found. While Iran was named a part of President George W. Bush's axis of evil in 2000, efforts to ignite a confrontation with Iran the point of it goes all the way back before 9/11. And, in fact, they have a timeline over at their website, this whole thing going all the way back to, frankly, 1992. Defense Secretary, in 1992, Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney And Pentagon staffer Louis Libby, Scooter Libby, wrote a classified defense planning guidance. It was also co-authored by World Bank Chief Paul Wolfowitz and Zalmay Khalilzad, the ambassador nominee to the United Nations. Cheney's aides called for the United States to assume the position of the lone superpower and act preemptively to prevent the emergence of even regional competitors. New York Times, Washington Post picked up on it, leaked it, created a huge brouhaha. In September of 2000, then, 8 years later, the Project for New American Century publishes this thing, Rebuilding America's Defenses, lays out the whole thing all over again. And, you know, on and on it goes. I mean, basically what we're seeing, people think, oh, yeah, you know, this he's going after Iran. That's a brand new idea. No. It's an old idea. And, in fact, Chuck Hagel says that he was asked about going after Iran, not specifically Iran, but in the original authorization for war in the Middle East that the Bush administration put forward back in 2002, that it didn't just specify Iraq, that it specified the entire Middle East. And Chuck Hagel says, hey, wait a minute, the entire Middle East? I mean, this is a little beyond the pale, isn't it? I mean, it's a little more than what we're talking about here. It's pretty mind-boggling. Pretty mind-boggling. So that's story number one. The other, in terms of, you know, the unreported stories of the day, the other one that is, you know, in the news in a small way, but it's starting to come unraveled. You know, we discovered when the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Associated Press, when a whole variety of USA Today, Knight Ritter, a whole variety of news organizations came together and created a consortium and said, okay, we're going to pay to transport all the ballots in Florida up to New York, or was it Washington, D.C., I forget which, and manually count them, have each one counted three times by a group of two people each, and we're going to add them all up using all the various criteria that the various different counties in Florida used or could have used. Intent of the voter, undervote, overvote, pregnant Chad, pimpled Chad, dimpled Chad, hanging Chad, no Chad, you know, what was going on. And this was not even counting all the people who, because of the misaligned butterfly ballot, the thousands of people who voted for Pat Buchanan thinking that they were voting for Al Gore. So anyhow, they did this count, and it was published on November 12th, 2001, a year after the election, in the New York Times and the Washington Post. The New York Times was quite explicit about it, and we found that no matter how you counted them, no matter how you added them up, regardless, intent of voter, pimpled Chad, dimpled Chad, pregnant Chad, hanging Chad, whatever, that Al Gore got more votes than Bill Clinton, than George W. Bush did. Sorry, well, I'm broadcasting here live from the Families USA conference. The radio row is out in the hall. One of the conferences, one of the speakers just ended, and there's like a zillion people walking around here. You can. That's what I'm surrounded by. So, if occasionally I seem distracted, people walking up and going, huh, what's this? Anyhow, no matter how, whatever the intent of the voter was, it's quite obvious that Al Gore won Florida in 2000, and therefore George W. Bush was appointed by the Supreme Court illegally, in my opinion. And if not illegally, certainly in defiance of the will of the people. I mean, the majority of the people in the United States voted for Al Gore, and the majority of the people in Florida voted for Al Gore. And we didn't find it out for a year. It was a month after 9/11. The New York Times buried the story, buried the lead 17 paragraphs into the story, but it's there, it's in print. Nobody can dispute it. Nobody's even trying to dispute it. So that's the 2000 election. George Bush was not elected. Al Gore was. Bush was appointed by the Supreme Court and sworn in. So now we fast forward to 2004. And the news story, and it's just being run as a small Associated Press story. But there's a bigger story here, and it's a huge story, frankly. The 2004 election was decided by 118,000 votes in Ohio. And, you know, I remember I was doing election coverage that night. I was for WDEV, one of our affiliates in Vermont. And Ken Squire, who owns the station and has been on the air for 50 years or so, great guy. And Ken invited me down because it was near where I lived. I lived in Montpelier. It's in Waterbury. I said, come on down and do some, you know, do some local election coverage with us. And so, you know, we stayed up until the wee hours and did this election coverage together. And I remember when we were using the wire feed. I think it was the AP feed. I'm not sure which one they subscribed to there at WDEV, but I believe it's AP. And the reporter came on and said, and this was around 10:30, 11 o'clock at night Eastern time, and said, Karen Hughes has just sat George W. Bush down and told him that he has lost the election, that he doesn't have enough votes, that he's lost the election. And he seems unconcerned. 25 minutes later, 25 minutes later, the same reporter came on and called the election and said Bush has won, not Kerry has won. Even though Karen Hughes had just told Bush that Kerry had won. What happened? There's a lot of people who think that something nasty was going on in Ohio. And so Bob Fitrakis and David Cobb, the Green Party candidate, and Michael, what's his name? I'm forgetting his last name. The Libertarian Party candidate. They sued. They sued for a recount. Now, the way the recount is supposed to be done, if you're going to have a statewide recount, first they pick three precincts, and they, you know, randomly. And they recount those. And if they find anything wrong, any odd thing going on with any of these three precincts, then that indicates that maybe we should look at the larger issue. Maybe we should spend the money on looking at the state. And they looked at those three precincts, and it looked like everything was just fine. And so, pretty much it. And now what we're discovering is that they lied. That the people in those precincts lie. Here's the Associated Press story. Two election workers were convicted yesterday, Wednesday, of rigging a recount of the 2004 presidential election to avoid a more thorough review in Ohio's most populous county. Jacqueline Maiden, elections coordinator for the Cuyahoga County Elections Board, and ballot manager Kathleen Dreamer, each were convicted of a felony count of negligent misconduct by an elections employee. They also were convicted of one misdemeanor count each of failure to perform their duty as elections officials. Prosecutors accused Maiden and Dreamer of secretly reviewing pre-selected ballots before a public recount on December 16, 2004. They worked behind closed doors for 3 days to pick ballots they knew would not cause discrepancies when checked by hand, prosecutors said. Now, this is a big deal. I mean, this is a huge big deal, and the reason why it's a big deal is because this county, Cuyahoga County, there's 600,000 votes cast in this county. This is a county that typically has 60% turnout, reported 60% turnout, excuse me. But in predominantly black districts, voters typically vote more than 80% Democratic. And in those largely black precincts, sometimes the turnout was only 30%. What happened to all the rest of the votes? In one ward, only 7% of voters showed up. Whereas the next ward over, and we're talking about, just like the next block over, it was 70%. So something really nasty went on. And we're talking, 118,000 votes, 56,000 votes had flipped the other way. John Kerry would be president right now. It's increasingly looking like not only did Bush steal the 2000 election, but he stole the 2004 election as well. And the dirty laundry in Ohio is just starting to come unraveled. Let's hope that there are some serious criminal investigations going forward. 16 minutes past the hour. And welcome back to the radio support group of By and For We the people of the United States of America. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Washington, D.C., the Families USA Conference. And a wild event it is. It's a large coalition of people involved in healthcare and working for healthcare, and extraordinary consensus, I think, coming out of all of this. This is a big issue. Obviously, one of many. You know, stolen elections. Holy cow! This thing is melting down. Our telephone number 1-866-440-8466. TomHartman.com, of course, our website. The Senate blowing up the raise of the minimum wage from $5.15 to $7.25 an hour. The Republicans in the Senate blowing this thing up. We'll see where that goes. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. This is a group that is neither Republican nor Democratic. It is not even bipartisan. It is simply nonpartisan. It's a bunch of bureaucrats with green eye shades who work for Congress, and Congress gives them jobs like, hey, check this out, check this out. They said Bush can either balance the budget within 5 years, or he can have his tax cuts. He can't have both. Scooter Libby trial. Former CIA Deputy Director Robert Grenier testified that he told Libby that Valerie Plame worked for the CIA a month before Libby said that NBC's Tim Russert had told him. So he knew this for a month before he said he knew it. Another CIA employee said he delivered a stark warning. This is amazing, this testimony in this trial. I mean, why? Let me finish the sentence here. Another CIA employee said he delivered a stark warning that the Bush administration's leak could lead to the deaths of people who aided American intelligence gathering abroad. What we had in this case was we had a CIA officer, Valerie Plame, who was playing undercover the role of president of a company, Brewster Jennings, which had offices all around the world. And in those offices all around the world, there were these actual CIA agents who were actually acting like corrupt local officials who were saying to local terrorist groups, I could get you some shoulder-fired missiles, sure. Or, you want some AK-47s? In other words, they were pretending to be a corrupt arms-dealing company. And people would say, I want this or I want that. And they go, let me check with Valerie Plame. She's the CEO of the company. Let's see if we can make this happen. So when her name got out, all over the world, these people who were working for Brewster Jennings, many of them were probably murdered. We don't know, because there has never been an investigation by Congress as to how many of these people were murdered as a result of Dick Cheney and Karl Rove outing Valerie Plame in revenge for Joe Wilson saying in the New York Times that George W. Bush was lying about uranium in Niger. This is revenge, pure and simple, on their part. And here now, yesterday in Scooter Libby's trial, CIA employee said he delivered a stark warning to the Bush administration that a leak like this could lead to the deaths of people who aided American intelligence gathering abroad, quote, end quote. I mean, it doesn't get much more straightforward than that. Why are we prosecuting Scooter Libby for lying about what he knew and when he knew it, and not prosecuting Dick Cheney and Karl Rove for outing a CIA officer? That's a crime. Why is there no criminal prosecution of that crime? Why is there no congressional investigation of that crime? You want to talk about high crimes and misdemeanors? I'll tell you, you start right there. That's, boy. And then Dick Cheney then goes running around. Here we have this not a terrible situation in Iraq. Play that clip, Andrew. Andrew, if you have it. 1 second, okay. Got Dick Cheney.
The current situation there is very unstable. The president himself speaks about a nightmare scenario right now. He was contained, as you repeatedly said throughout the 90s, after the first Gulf War, in a box, Saddam Hussein.
He was, after the first Gulf War, had managed to kick out all the inspectors. He was providing suicide bombers.
Clinton pulled
them out. He was a safe haven for terror, as one of the prime state sponsors of terrorist designated.
No, he wasn't.
For a long time.
He hated terrorists.
He had violated 16 UN Security Council resolutions. If he were still there today, we'd have a terrible situation.
But there is a terrible situation.
No, there is not. There is not. There's problems, ongoing problems.
That's incredible. That's incredible. He strings together a bunch of lies. I mean, that should be an impeachable offense. The Vice President of the United States speaking to America in the news media, stringing together a series of lies, and then denying reality. Oh, no, we don't have a terrible situation in Iraq. No. 3,000 dead Americans, 50,000 wounded, 600,000 dead Iraq. No, nothing wrong with that. The entire area contaminated with depleted uranium. Nothing wrong with it at all. Amazing. I'll be back with your thoughts on all this and more of the news of the day right after this break. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Number 866-440-THOM, TomHartmann.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. 27 minutes past the hour.
Who's on the hill and who's watching the valley? Who's in charge of it all? God bless the army and God bless our liberty. That comes the rest of it all. Tell men in position of back and away. Freedom's stuck in reverse. Let's get out of Iraq. Get back on the track and let's rebuild America first.
You tell Merle Haggard, let's get out of Iraq. Let's get back on track. Let's rebuild America first. 34 minutes past the... I'm telling you, when you've lost the Okie from Muskogee guy, you've lost America. This is over the top. Chuck Hagel, the Republican senator from Nebraska, increasingly outspoken Republican senator from Nebraska. Yesterday, Dick Cheney, of course, you heard a piece of that just a few minutes ago. Dick Cheney told Wolf Blitzer, the biggest threat in the Iraq war right now is that the American public may not have the stomach for the fight. So Chuck Hagel, Gwen Ifill on PBS NewsHour, says to Chuck Hagel, what do you think about that? You know what Dick Cheney says, that the biggest threat is that America doesn't have the stomach for the fight. And he said that he's astounded that the vice president, quote, so underestimates the people of this country and has so little faith in this country to say something like that. He suggested that Cheney should talk to the families of the soldiers and tell them that they don't have the stomach for a fight. Amazing. I never thought I would be on this program holding up Chuck Hagel as a paragon of virtue. And I'm not, I guess, you know, broadly, but he's saying some good stuff. Alex in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, Alex, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, good afternoon. Oh, it was the thing about, you know, changing the comment about whether it's a stomach or whether it's hogwash. You know, somebody had to look into how much money Cheney makes a week. I think it's about $1 million a week he makes off this war.
Yeah,
it goes personally into his pocket.
Yeah, and not to mention all his friends and buddies and, yeah.
I mean, all the war profiteers, you know, even when they financed, you know, Putin to take over Locus Oil. I mean, these guys got their pockets so deep in the oil and all this stuff. And you know, they're just using us like serfs did, you know, back in the days of royalty.
Yeah,
you know,
well, and they want us to be serfs because, if, you know, serfs generally don't rise up. The Middle Ages were a very stable time. You didn't have any middle class. You had a lot of very, very poor people, and they basically suffered in their poverty and kept their mouths shut.
Oh, absolutely. And they just took what they got. You know, that was my main thing. And there's a saying, and it's a famous Arab saying. It says that they would rather live with a decade of tyranny than one day of chaos.
Interesting. I've not heard that, Alex, but that's interesting. Well, they certainly have the chaos now and the tyranny. Jim in San Francisco. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Tom. First of all, as an ex-Clevelander, I wanted to say, boy, I'm sure glad they finally got some evidence on that. And, you know, that's Kucinich's home territory, so
I know.
He should be spearheading the efforts to get some hearings going in Congress on that. I think that's huge.
Well, it is huge, and I'm just astounded that the news media is treating it like, well, you know, a couple guys got convicted. I mean, it's the same thing as in New Hampshire when the Republican Party jammed, they hired this guy who jammed, well, actually, they didn't hire him, he was a Republican Party official, jammed the phone lines at the local fire station and the local, you know, this whole local Democratic get-out-the-vote thing. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence of that, I believe it was John Sununu. I'm not sure which of the two New Hampshire Republicans it was, but he was running against Gene Shaheen, who was the governor of New Hampshire, and a Democrat, and a very, very popular governor. I mean, you know, it's a, New Hampshire's a very conservative state. Their license plate says "Live Free or Die." I mean, that's of course it's stamped by guys in prison, but it, nonetheless, that's what it says. And right. I lived in New Hampshire for 5 years. I know that state. And Jean Shaheen, this Democrat, was running, and she lost by just a few thousand votes. I mean, maybe not even that. Maybe it was a few. I mean, just a squeaker. And it turns out that the entire Democratic get-out-the-vote effort was all the phone lines were jammed for 2 days by the Republicans, and this guy was convicted and sent to jail. And he got all kinds of money from Karl Rove and from the White House to defend himself, and you know, but nobody said, hey, maybe the election should be revisited. I mean, the Republicans steal an election, and people go, well, they stole an election. You know, throw some guy under the bus. You know, the Republicans, they out a CIA agent, bring down a counterterrorism program that, among other things, is looking into weapons of mass destruction in Iran. Yeah, let's just throw Scooter Libby under the bus. Just make sure it doesn't go up to Bush or Cheney. I mean, the level of cynicism and corruption is tragic. It is not what this country is all about. These guys do not reflect the values of America.
Well, that's right. And this time, I really think now, with the momentum going, that there'll be an investigation. But what I really called about was when you're talking about mercenaries.
Yes, sir.
And I saw, the documentary Iraq for Sale.
Yeah, I saw it, too.
I got to tell you.
In fact, I saw it with Robert Greenwald in the studio.
I got to tell you, as a veteran who used to wash his own clothes, right?
Yep.
To watch a documentary that says these guys over there are having their clothes washed by private contractors. They don't even have to wash their own clothes. But we, the taxpayers, it's costing us $100 every time one of those guys' clothes are washed.
I know.
This is, I think, all veterans across the country hearing this right now. To remember washing their own clothes ought to be outrage.
Yeah, for
now, the movie
per bag of laundry. I mean, you know, if you want to give that $100 to the GIs, but the bottom line is you don't even need to do that. I mean, the bottom line is this is just figuring out this whole so-called privatization scheme in Iraq.
Yeah, exactly.
Just figuring out another way to take our tax dollars and give them to Cheney and Bush's buddies.
Exactly. Now the other thing is I saw another documentary last night called Shadow Company. I don't know if you've heard about this or not.
I have not, no.
But it is a documentary about mercenaries, and it's as a history buff, I know that you'll enjoy this component because there's a clip in there about the development of mercenaries through beginning with Romans all the way up through the Middle Ages, etc. It's got a lot of good statements by mercenaries. It's got some background information on how mercenaries have been used to overthrow some of the governments in Africa. Mm-hmm. It's got a good discussion about the fact that these mercenaries are operating with no rules. They're not accountable to U.S. rules. They're not accountable to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. They're not accountable to anybody.
Right. And Bush is calling for more of this in his State of the Union address. I mean, it's
and this, when you add this into what you are about, the only person talking about this very poorly described new layer. You know, what these guys are good at is creating new layers. They created, you know, the enemy combatant that now doesn't have habeas corpus. They create these new layers of infrastructure that have no rules. And this new civilian corps, undescribed but alluded to, it could easily be the place where these unemployed contractors become part of.
Yeah.
And when we get out of Iraq, I mean, it's a
I think we all need to be very concerned about this
nightmarish scenario.
Yep, I agree, Jim. Thank you for the call and for bringing that out. It's a good point, Joel in San Francisco, in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Excuse me. Hey, Joel.
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
Yeah. I was just calling in regards to our resolution here for impeachment, and I was trying to stir up some people for it. Because what has happened is we have introduced the bill into the roundhouse. And but what we found is that we suffered death through through committees.
Right.
Basically, we've been shoved into three different committees. So I was going to encourage people, if they live in the state of New Mexico, to call the Roundhouse and try to get them out of these committees to expedite the process.
Right.
And the other thing, and this is through Jefferson's rules, and I've been listening to you talk about the impeachment thing, and one thing I don't really understand, based on your argument, is that if you have to investigate first before you impeach, that makes Jefferson's rule, it's not applicable. You can't use it.
Why not?
Well, because you what you say is you have to investigate first before you can impeach.
Well, you have to have a crime. If a state government, if my understanding of Jefferson's rules is right, and it may not be, but I think I understand them. First of all, these are basically just rules for the behavior of the House of Representatives. Right now, the way it is that an individual member of the House of Representatives can submit a resolution calling for the impeachment of the president. You know, that has been done. That was done last year. It didn't go anywhere. It got ignored. But basically, what Jefferson's rules say is that an individual state can behave as if it were a member of the House of Representatives and can also submit an article of impeachment, a bill for impeachment. But that doesn't mean that impeachment's going to happen. That doesn't mean that the House is going to consider it. It doesn't mean the House is going to, bring it forward. It's just another way of opening the door.
Well, one advantage, too, is, according to Jefferson's rules, is that, if we do submit this and it gets through the legislature, we are guaranteed 1 hour on the floor of the House of Representatives as a debate.
Oh, right. And that's the big point. I mean, what this is, back to the parade, back to Roy from Rio Rancho's parade. I mean, it's all about the parade. It's all about saying, hey, there's a whole bunch of people out here. Here you have, half a dozen states who, under Jefferson's rules, are trying to get impeachment resolutions before the United States Congress. At that point, members of the House of Representatives sit up and take notice and say, hey, wait a minute, I can't ignore this anymore. I can't pretend this isn't going on. This isn't real. So I'm entirely supportive of it. I just also am strongly supportive of it, in fact, because I think it's a very, very good grassroots effort, and those are the most important. And at the same time, let's not fool ourselves into thinking that that's going to be the end of the Bush administration.
Well, so, I don't think it is either, but it's a point to start because...
Yeah, it is. It is. It's an excellent start. Joel, thank you for the call. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
I am a patriot, and I love my country, because my country is all I need.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, occasionally from Washington and Jay and Mason, not some right-wing think tank. Broadcasting live from the belly of the beast here in Washington, D.C., the Families USA Conference, people working together to make sure that everybody in America has health care. Steve in Springfield, Massachusetts, our number 1-866-440-THOM. 440-8466. Steve in Springfield, you're live and on the air. Hey, Steve.
Yeah, hi, Tom. How are you? I was listening to, I can't remember the congressman from the 6th District.
Yes.
Who you had on. I want to put my 2 cents in. I agree with you that we really need a single-payer system, but short of that, I just can't, if we're going to have one of these patchwork or incremental things, these people really have to be aware of a couple of problems, such as the American people are barely free to change jobs because of, particularly if they have a family, and God forbid they should have a dependent who has a catastrophic illness or a chronic illness. They can't, so short of a single-payer system, if we're going to cut in any of these companies or special interests, we've got to have in this country an ID card, a single ID card as a right from the point of birth, such as that which they have in the countries which have national health care.
Right.
And you retain for your entire life, whether you've gotten fired or you've done, you know, they're also doing a disservice to our supposedly great entrepreneurial economy.
Yep.
You know, a middle-class person is petrified to leave a corporate job for an to pursue an entrepreneurial venture if he needs, he or she needs help.
Oh, I know, and we're supposed to be encouraging risk. And then here's a further, you know, weirdness. Bush, you know, in recognizing his entrepreneur up in the gallery during his State of the Union address, what is it? Somebody who built up a company and sold it off to Disney. That's the new American dream? Build something up and sell it off to a big multinational corporation? I mean, what? Say what? But, you know, it's interesting. I was sitting here. Candy Stroud is one of the folks who is working with this group, you know, helping organize things. And Candy and I have known each other for a few years. She used to work with the Democratic National Committee, Democratic Party. And now she has a company, Stroud & Associates, that does, you know, this kind of stuff. And she picked up my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. And she said, why are they doing this? And I said, it's because they want slaves. They want us to be in slavery. The two high points of the American middle class were the 1770s, when we overthrew a king, and the 1970s, when we overthrew Nixon. I mean, it's basically, you know, another king. When you have a strong, an economically strong middle class, when people feel safe and secure, when they know that their health care is covered, when they know that the community is solid, when they know that they have some baseline of wealth, when they know that if they lose their job, they can easily find another one, when they know that they're not going to go hungry, they're not going to be wiped out by disease, then they move up Maslow's hierarchy of human needs into the intellectual and spiritual needs and into which I would throw things like the idea of democracy. And they start saying, hey, wait a minute. You know, us African Americans, we got left behind. Or us gay people, we got left behind. Or us women, I mean, you know, we got left behind. Or you know, and the list goes on and on and on. And people start saying, and the students, you know, I mean, in the 1970s, they were saying, hell no, we won't go. And so the conservatives look at this and they go, this is a country out of control. Look at all these people. They're protesting these women. They're burning their bras. How dare they? You know, we can't have this. So how do we do this? We strip away their economic security. And to quote Alan Greenspan in the New York Times, in the Wall Street Journal in 1997, provide a certain minimum level of worker insecurity. And when you have that certain level of worker insecurity, you no longer have people standing out. You no longer have people speaking up. You no longer have mass demonstration, although we're going to have one here in Washington, D.C. day after tomorrow. But it's getting harder and harder and harder. In particular, local action, in particular, things like strikes, people saying, no, I'm not going to go to work for a week. These kind of things happen in Europe because people know that when they come back, they'll still have a job because the government requires it. But here, no, they're wiping out our middle class, and they're doing it specifically because basically, A, it's nice for corporations to have slaves, it's very profitable, and B, they don't want protests. Steve, thank you very much for the call. Good to hear from you. Richard in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Richard.
Hey, Tom, how are you today? Keep up the good fight.
Thank you.
Hey, one on the Brewster Jennings things, not only will this criminal administration do we have, but possibly anybody with Joe Wilson being a diplomat previously, probably all these countries look at the embassies as being a web of CIA agents, being the Valerie Plame was with the CIA.
Right.
And I wonder why these Italian Niger documents, nobody's ever really been able to find out where these originated from.
Probably they have.
Probably from our own government.
We found out where they started. In fact, it was in the news, and we talked about it in this program. The documents were done by a number two or number three guy in the Italian Secret Service, the Italian Intelligence Service, at the request of Berlusconi as a favor to Bush, and then they were leaked to the British so that the British could then hand them off to Bush. Yeah.
But anyway, endangering our embassy personnel because, you know, probably in effect that is, there are people in there that are keeping an eye on things. But one quick point, Tom, before I leave you, have you heard about the Divine Strike?
No.
Divine Strike, it's a test. It's a bunker buster test. It's going on in Arizona.
Yeah, you're talking about Operation Divine Strike, yeah, where they're blowing off all that enormous amount of explosive. That's in Nevada, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's a 5,000-pound bomb. But anyway, this is, I think, a lead-up to Iran, and evidently there's quite enough war between the for the people in Arizona?
Well, there is, yeah. And the main uproar is that this thing is going to kick up, you know, radioactive dust from 50 years ago from the old atomic tests. But it's also, yeah, I agree with you. This is there's all this muscle flexing going on. So, anyhow, we'll be broadcasting again tomorrow from here, from the Families USA Conference from Washington, D.C., getting ready for the big protests on Saturday. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.